When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a huge guest, a music legend, a skateboarding legend, Todd Congelier, is on the show. You may know Todd from FYP, Toys That Kill, Underground Railroad to Candyland. You may know him from any number of projects. You may know him from his fantastic long-running record label, Recess Records. But today, you will know him as an amazing guest on this podcast. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with us over here, head over to the email address turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at @LeftForDamien. There is a TikTok page, a YouTube page, a Facebook page, an Instagram page, all for this podcast. All those can be found at turnedoutofpunk on those respective platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that we do each and every week here at Turned Out of Punk. You can also check out the band I play in. We're called Fucked Up. You can find us over at fuckedup.cc. There is a new record we have out called Another Day. We're going to be going on tour to England very soon. Actually, maybe other places in the UK too. So check tour dates for that. And hopefully we'll see you there. Come hang out. Chill. Talk about this podcast with me. I love doing that. And that is that. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, Todd from FYP is on the show. Todd is one of the all-time greats. Like, I love FYP. What an incredible band. And he's done, obviously, other stuff since then. Everything he does is incredible, too, including Recess Records, as we talk about in depth on this episode. We go into minutia about Recess Records, and really, you know, I describe him as the Roger Corman of punk, and believe me, I stand by that, and I will hope that you will see maybe where I'm coming from by the time this thing's all said and done. Todd has put out two amazing records in the last year. Well, he's put out a bunch with Recess Records, but I mean, played on two incredible records, Clown Sound, which is fantastic, and also with Turn It A Punk friend of the show and all-around punk rock legend, The Jump started Plow Hands with one Mike Watt, and they've put out their second LP, Round 2. Round 1 came out 5 years ago now. So pick up those records. Pick up all this other great stuff that came out on Recess Records. There's stuff with The Arrivals. They did Kill the Musicians, Volume 1, one of my favorite compilation of band stuff all the time, Screeching Weasel's record. There's so much stuff, so much great stuff on this label, so much great stuff to talk about that I'm not going to ramble on anymore. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Todd Congelier on Turned Out of Punk. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I like it.
Well, I appreciate you being here because, as I was warning you off air, this is going to get nerdy. This is the conversation that's not appropriate to subject someone through backstage at a venue in Los Angeles. This is something you got to do in an appropriate setting, which is, you know, under the guise of a podcast.
Well, you must be considerate because you're giving me a warning. So that's all I need.
Well, you can jump off at any time, I guess. But, like, this is your last chance to say, no, there's no fucking way I want to go through this. But welcome to the show. There's a lot to talk to you about, I think, in addition to kind of being this incredible auteur of punk, I think through your various projects, and there's like a sonic that you developed very early that's like really neat to kind of follow as a fan through the various things you do develop. And it's like, I don't know, there's people like that in music that you can kind of see that with, you know, and I think Lou Barlow's someone like that, you know, there's like these sorts of people like that have these sorts of careers where they're doing different projects. And obviously it's not always sounding like the exact same thing in the way your solo records don't necessarily sound like FYP, but there's a voice there that's kind of present the whole way through. Plus, through the label and actually through your bands too, you're kind of the Roger Corman of this punk rock world, you know, connecting a lot of people and giving a lot of people their start. Better product in the end than Roger Corman put out a lot of times himself.
I was going to say not worthy, but yeah.
I'm glad because there is a genius to Roger Corman as well.
I agree.
Well, I got to start it off the way they all start off, which is, Todd, how'd you get a punk from the first time you ever came across it?
How did I get into punk?
Yeah. When was the first time you ever, even the first time you heard the word type thing?
Well, I grew up in the South Bay of Southern California, not Northern California. So, when I was a kid, I would see Black Flag, Descendants, Minutemen flyers, like wheat pasted on, you know, signs, stoplights everywhere. And then there was one day I specifically remember, we were at a stoplight, and it was on PCH and Calimur Drive, and I saw a Black Flag flyer, and I said, I want to go to that. And my mom said, you're not going to that. Like, people get stabbed there. You know, like, it's just like this. She's very protective, you know. Like, she gave it to me for my kids, so I'm torturing them now. But she did not want me to go, convinced that I would be stabbed or, you know, beat up or something, you know, violence, like drugs, everything, all the worst parts of humanity. So I was like, well, I don't want to get stabbed. So maybe she's right. I won't go. And then fast forward a couple of years later, I started building ramps, like skate ramps in my backyard. And all the local skaters would bring over 7 Seconds, Black Flag, Germs, and we'd put in the tape deck. And I realized, I was like, this makes me skate a little bit more aggressive. Like, there's something to this. And, you know, like, it just sank from there. And I still thought it was filthy. I still thought there was some seedy underbelly to it. And I didn't know what was in the store for me later on.
I get what you're saying about the being an overprotective parent and, you know, kind of recognizing that now in my own parents and their kind of fear of it. But I think with where you're getting into it, a lot of that's media hype, but there's also some legitimate, there's like legitimate fears too, right? Like, people are getting stabbed at some of these shows.
Well, after I started going to shows, and then, you know, there was that first show where I went and woke up my mom at, you know, 1 a.m. saying it was the most beautiful experience in the world. You know, it was, you know, 7 Seconds at Fender's Ballroom. It was, you know, a little, I think it was right before they went to New Wind and, but it was this positive, you know, like you would imagine any sort of, you know, it was right before Youth of Today and all that real posy core type stuff, but it was positive without thinking that we're getting into something positive. I mean, I went there thinking I've got to have a swivel neck and don't talk to anybody. Don't look at anybody funny. And it was nothing like that. It was people helping each other up. And so I woke up my mom to tell her, like, Mom, it was the most, I can't even describe this experience. And you could just tell she's like, I want to go back to sleep. That's great that you're alive. And she's like, you smell like cigarettes. And I'm like, I didn't smoke. And I'm like, yeah, a lot of people were in there smoking. So, you know, at the Straight Edge show, I guess. So that, I mean, it was the media for sure. I mean, it was, you know, it was in Quincy, it was in Chips at the time, and they were bad people. These punks, you know, they needed the medical examiner and the highway patrol, you know, to stop them. And that there was definitely some of that. But I also, went to shows for a couple years after that first magical experience, saw someone literally get stabbed and crawl out, try to crawl out of the the room, and security tried to help them, and then the people that stabbed them, like, roughed up security, and I didn't go to shows for about a year after that. And then that was, so that was, you know, my mom was right, I guess, for that situation. But then right after that, I started going to shows again because of, you know, Youth of Today started coming to town, and anything 7 Seconds had anything to do with, I was there, and they put out the first 7-inch. So I was like, I'm gonna go check this out. And it's, you know, it was good. It was like, oh, this is back to positivity. No one's getting stabbed again. And so there was a lot of media, but I did see some real punk rock violence back in the day. And it happened. Like, if you went to go see Agnostic Front, you're going to see some violence for sure, because gangs show up. And Southern California, and I feel like I started a little late compared to where the real violence was happening. I think it kind of subsided a little bit by the time I started going to shows. So
yeah, like it seems like it hits, especially in that part of America, it hits like a tipping point in terms of the violence that, and it almost kills off the scene. But that's at the same time as you're saying, like, I guess Uniform Choice and Justice League into Chain of Strength and sort of this like other posse scene starting. Seven Seconds is a band that like everyone says, you know, and every run-in I've ever had with them has been amazing, but like you never hear people talk shit on them.
Well, they did once
musically.
Yeah, like there was, there was, I mean, I was the odd man out on that one, because, you know, I remember the day I went in, we had a Tower Records, and I went in and I was like, new 7 Seconds. Oh, only on cassette. That's cool. That's what we skate to. And I got it. And I was like, I thought I was king shit of Fuck Mountain bringing in the new 7 Seconds. And everyone was like, I heard it. They suck now. And I'm like, no, let's put it on. And it was a totally different thing. But I was like, I held strong. I was like, no, they're still the best band ever. And you got to keep in mind, I was like a Swifty to 7 Seconds. I was combing through Maximum Rock and Roll classifieds, looking for anything that said. I mean, I was like a web crawler back then. It's like 7 Seconds, 7 Seconds, Kevin, Kevin. What's this, Kevin Stead? What's he trying to do? I'll check it out. And then it was like, instead, they sound enough like 7 Seconds to make me love them. So I saw them probably more than any band ever when I was a kid. So yeah, it was like 7 Seconds was definitely, and to this day, there are people, you know, just with all the reissues and people coming out and saying that, yeah, they were Taylor Swift to me, you know.
It's funny because the other day in the car, my kids are all picking, you know, Chappelle Roan and like different songs to play. And I put on We'll Make the Difference. And it's like, that song is one of the greatest songs. That's Andrew WK before there was an Andrew WK.
Yeah, wow.
It also feels like there was that kind of like energy that's happening in it, where there's sort of this positivity in the face of, you know, like you're saying, the real violence that's kind of happening. Like people were being stabbed. People were being like, like there was sort of this gang element that was really, I guess, pervasive at that point. But
yeah, I mean, it depended on what bands were playing. Like it's like Suicidal Tendencies, you know, something's going down. There's like, you know, there was the Skinheads and the Sueys, and they would all, and if they showed up, it was just a very combustive element, you know, to say the least. And I fortunately was kind of neutral, because I dressed more like a skater. I had skater shorts and then the, you know, 7 Seconds t-shirt, which, you know, I don't know if that was fashionable or whatnot. It was just what I put on, but I definitely was neutral. So I got the hang of it, where I was like, you know, as long as you don't talk shit. And then it just became this thing where it's like, no, none of that's happening anymore. Like, this is a new, it's a new wind.
I think history's judged New Wind very well. Like I got into it later, so that record wasn't as verboten, but there was still that older head element that was like, oh, they're good until New Wind, but then once New Wind hits, yeah, it gets weird. But I don't know, I love that record, and I think even I've got love in my heart now for Drop Acid.
Yeah, I mean, I gave everything a chance, anything he did. So it was, I mean, Praise. I loved Praise when that came out, and people were like, "You're taking this too far. I think it's a pride thing, and you don't want to be wrong." And I'm like, "No, I actually love this. I could sing. I know every lyric." I was just diehard with that, you know. And it also, I love that I went through that because I kind of went through the same thing, but it was a lot childish, you know, like with FYP when we changed kind of from Dance My Dunce to Toilet Kids Bread. I got so much hate mail, and there was no internet back then, so it wasn't lazy like lazy hidden dudes in their basement. Like, it was, people took the time to write a long letter telling me that I should die, you know, over this. And I'm like, wait, is this what Kev went through? I was like, no, he didn't. He did not get this kind of nasty shit. Like, people were just like, whatever. You know, like, it was, but it definitely prepared me for what's in store, where people are going to love the shit out of you and then turn their backs. Not only turn their backs, which is fine. You could turn your back, but like write hate mail and death threats. And I mean, I remember at recess, we were just like plastering them all over the wall. And it was like the first week of shipping a new record, which was like, I never thought I would have to experience that in my 20s, you know, but it was basically like, well, let's just wear it with pride. Like, this is fun. This one's funny. And it's like, oh, this one's not, should I be worried? I don't, yeah, no, it's fine. Let's put it up. And, I would always fondly look back at that. I was like, no, I liked them when they changed and they progressed into what they wanted to do, you know? And now people do that. And especially take a band like your band, you could go in any direction and people are going to respect it and love it. You might have a different take on that. But it's,
yeah, like I think you know, I there are definitely people that are like, only till the first, they sucked once they hit the LP, you know, and they signed to J-Tree, then they were terrible. Or like, once they went to Matador, they sucked. And I think that's the thing, is if you're a musician, you're always competing against people's nostalgia. Like, that's going to your biggest enemy, is that people have this like romantic attachment to like one period of your career. And there are certain bands who found a way to never change what they were doing. And I respect that. But like, to me, that's like, that'd be a hard slog to kind of go through life making the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's death to me, you know. It's like, or artistic death, you know. It's like, I've never gotten to a point where it's like, no, we have to do this. It has to sound like this. You know, it's like, that to me is why am I doing, I don't make enough money to do that. Like, there's, you know, it has to be moving forward and fun, you know, and what you want to actually, you know, tell the world about yourself, you know, it has to be that, or there's just really nothing else in it for me besides that.
Yeah, 100%. Like, that's the end game of it. That's what separates it from being just, I guess, the idea of making a commodity and the idea of being, quote unquote, I guess, an artist, or, you know, the least cynical way of saying a creator. Because like, that's what, you know, what you're trying to do. You're trying to express yourself and make things that resonate with people, but you're also trying to like be honest and grow. And like, I think my relationship to bands and their quote unquote sellout records or departure records changed so much once I was in a band and realizing like, it's not calculated. It's just something that bands are, for the most part, there's sometimes it's very calculated, but for the most part, what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can tell, like, you know, most of us are pretty smart. You could tell when it is calculated and there's a formula and there's somebody, you know, it's like Rumpelstiltskin whispering in Shrek's ear. It's like that. You could tell when that's happening. And it, that just doesn't appeal to me. It's like, it just doesn't feel right. And what else can I say? But, you know, you gotta trust people that are moving in a direction that they know they have to move in, you know, and you could like it or not. And that's your choice. So.
You brought up skateboarding in the Instead shirt, and I went back and watched your part from Liberty Horror, and you've got like the Gorilla Biscuit shirt on at one point, and you've got an SSD sticker on your helmet. at another point. So it's like the whole way through you're repping kind of punk and hardcore. And it feels like obviously that there's such a deep connection between the two worlds of skateboarding and punk and hardcore, but it almost like seems to be splitting off a little bit, or like less overtly punk and hardcore as time goes on into the 90s.
Yeah, I didn't even think it was anymore. I thought it was with skating. I don't even know like what music skaters like, because there's so many skaters now. Like it's so diverse than, you know, back then it was the bikers were into Metallica and the punks were into Black Flag, and that was just, you know, it was almost just like a, you're getting, here's your sword and here's your rifle, now go out. And we had that. There was a biker that had a ramp close to my house, which was kind of rare back then to have two ramps in the same city, but he had the BMX ramp, and we were friendly with each other. We weren't like what you see in the media where BMXers versus skaters and they're fighting, but no, he was a nice guy. And but we'd go to skate his ramp, and it would just be Master of Puppets all day long. There was no other album that he ever played. We even made up songs where it was like Mike Tokimoto was the master. Oh, yeah, because we just didn't like want to care about the lyrics. I mean, I love that record now, but at the time I was like, no, this is fast, but not the same. And then, ironically, everything I was listening to started to get into that metal where it was like, Metallica's better than this. Like they had this down. Like, what are they trying to do? They're not even going jigga jigga jigga, you know, like they're just going chon chon. You know, so it was like this. We were trying to like compare the metals, and but yeah, skating was hand in hand. You open up a Thrasher, and there would always be a punk band being interviewed or reviewed. They were connected in every way. And most of the stuff that I did learn, besides the guys bringing over tapes, was the skate videos. They would have not just the ones that the companies made, but they made these contest videos where they would just have the music on live at the contest through a boombox or, you know, the PA. And I would always, and, you know, no Shazam, no nothing. You'd have to, like, hear the song and then word it to somebody. Like there's this song, and they're saying, and everyone would just be like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? You know, and it's 999 high energy. You know, it's like you find it out later, and you're like, "Oh my!" You found the record at a store that you just guessed. Like, I remember Lance Mountain telling in some interviews saying to somebody that Stiff Little Fingers was his favorite band. So I was like, and Lance Mountain was my favorite skater. So I was like, I gotta stop listening to 7 Seconds for a little bit to check out the Stiff Little Fingers band, and thinking that it was a song that he skated to, because it's like back then when I was a kid, it's like if you say your favorite band Stiff Little Fingers, then that's all you listen to. Like you're not gonna play another song. But he played this song during a skate run, and I was like, okay, that has to be Stiff Little Fingers. And so I went to about 7 different record stores, taking buses, skating to them, and whatever I had to do as a kid to get these Stiff Little Fingers records, and none of the records had that song on it. And I was disappointed.
What was the song?
Oh, I found it. Jesus Christ. I found it like a year ago, and I can't, it's all, I can't even think of it still. It's
no problem. As long as you found it eventually.
It's something you've heard of, but like it's more obscure than Stiff Little Fingers, but just how ridiculous that is. You know, now I think Stiff Little Fingers, you know, and not just now, but even a year after that, I was like, wait, these records are good. Why was I disappointed? Like, this is just something else. Like, it's not that song, but, and if you compare it now to that song that I was desperately needing, it's like, Stiff Little Fingers are just, they're blowing this out of the water. I'm sorry, but you did a good thing searching down these records. And, yeah, it was always just like interweaved with each other. It was like skating, punk, and, you know, you couldn't go to a ramp without, I went to one guy's ramp, and that's where I first heard 7 Seconds. It was that Wasted Life Ain't No Crime song. And that was it. It was seriously just like this thing. And I think I told this to somebody else in some interview, but I thought they were saying wet boys, you know. I was just like skating. I was like, yeah, my mom's right. They're like, these guys are perverts, but I like it. I like it a lot. And I don't care. Like, I'm thinking wet boys, what does that mean? Oh, they're just having sex. You know, like I mean, that's my mind. It's not my mom's fault. It's not 7 Seconds' fault. It's my fault. But, I had to get a copy of that song. It was just like this desperate, situation, and I ended up finding it. I was like, they're not saying, they're saying some intelligent shit here. Like, what's going on? And it just started to like slowly, you know, I'd get some Maximum Rock and Rolls, and it was slowly like dawning on me. It's like these people are probably more intelligent than my teachers. And whether that was true or not, I assume that they were my teachers, and looking back at it now, they definitely were.
Oh yeah. Like I say this all the time, and it's come up from other people. Like Kurt Vile talked about it on the podcast. Like, I learned more from Propagandhi than I did in most of my classes in school.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So,
like, especially when they start dropping texts and stuff that they were reading, and Noam Chomsky stuff and all this sort of thing. And yeah, like introduced me to that kind of world. I'm like, and yeah, the Max Rock and Roll news section too, like had more better information than a lot of the stuff that you were reading in international sections in your newspaper.
Yeah. For sure. It was stuff that you could like apply to yourself, and it was stuff that you were interested in. So I noticed that I only learn when I'm interested in something, and I'm not, it's really hard for me to learn it. And, you know, that's not just as a kid, as an adult too. Like, it's, you have to be involved and interested to fully absorb something.
I'm certainly not an expert in skateboarding and skateboarding history, but I've certainly watched some of your stuff over the years and heard you described as one of the best vert skaters of all time, potentially style-wise. And certainly you're coming into that at a changing period, it seems, as like vert and street and the transition to sort of street skateboarding is kind of coming in.
I was the Roger Corman of skating.
So. Yeah, Roger Corman of skating. Well, I'm going to get to that. Believe me, I got evidence. I got evidence to back that up. That's not just like some flagrant claim I'm throwing out there. But before that, you know, before you're doing the band and the label, like as skateboarding's kind of changing, did you feel that? Like, you know, because you're pro at this point as a skateboarder. Was there like enough money to kind of continue going down that path, and you kind of deliberately chose music, or did it feel like that's going some other way and I gotta, you know, not career-wise do something else, but just for whatever reason do something else?
Yeah, I think it was more of a, not just a, what I was more interested in, because I was still a kid, you know. So there wasn't like just this moment where it was like, I'm just sticking to this. But I do remember a few things. I mean, I definitely didn't make as much money as I should have. I think my guy ripped me off a little bit, but we're cool. We're all good. But I did make more money than any 16, 17 year old should have made at that time. You know, I remember getting a $700 check and going, whoa. Turns out it should have been like 7,000, but like it was, to me, $700 was like, what am I gonna do with this? And my best friend at the time, Jeremy Klein, he was another pro skater, and so we just hung out all the time, went skating, and I just remember me and him would play all these video games, so it was just me, I would just spend all my money on video games and candy. And I was like, yeah, that's what we're supposed to be doing. But in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm wasting this money. I got to do something. And then I just bought a 4-track one day and started making songs. And I had this thing where it's like, if you're going to come over to skate my ramp, you have to do backup vocals. So the first two FYP demo tapes, which were tapes that I sold, they weren't demos. They were just like, yeah, this is a sellable product, I guess. I just didn't know it at the time. I would make people that would come over to my ramp do the backups, and all, like, you could hear it on the first 7-inch and the first few tapes. It's just guys that can't sing that show up. I'm like, all right, I'll do it. If I could skate your ramp, here we go. All right, now let's go skate. We're done with that. And then I would just make all these tapes. And then there was one specific day that I remember. I think Jeremy got mad at me because I wanted to like record instead of go skate. And it was like this thing where it's like, oh, you're doing that now. That's it. And I was like, no, that's not, I like doing both, but just right now I'm going to do this. And then I was just doing that. It just turned into this thing where I still skated, but I didn't, I was kind of like done with the, I specifically remember in Germany, I got flown out to do a series of contests and demos and all this stuff. And I showed up to the contest and I was just completely unprepared. And I saw everybody skating. I'm like, oh, something happened in the last 6 months where, I haven't been able to like practice or skate or anything. Cause, you know, my parents got the house taken away. So that means my ramp got taken away and some bank grabbed my ramp. And, so I couldn't skate for like 6 months and I just showed up in Germany and everything just passed me. And it was just like, I just remember going, this is it. This is my last trip and I'm not doing this anymore. And it got weird too, like personally with people that you had to travel with. And it was like a new crew. You know, when I was first doing skating tours, it was just, the crew was awesome. Like people that, you know, it was like Jason, Jesse, or like mostly like Mark Gonzalez, Ron Chapman, Jason Lee, just really, really like cool, friendly dudes. And then it just turned into this thing where it's like, I don't know if I like this guy. Like, he's kind of weird. And then everyone just got so entitled after a while. And I was like, you're making money skateboarding. You should shut the fuck up. Like, you should appreciate this and stop acting like a dick to everybody. And it was just like this thing where I didn't feel like I belonged, but I realized that's just been the way it's been my whole life. I feel like the redheaded stepchild everywhere I go. Like, even once I started getting into music, it was like that, where FYP would play with emo and ska bands all the time. And they would just be like, why is this band? It's like, because it's 90s and it's punk. Like, it's all the same thing. Like, you guys sound similar. Like, no, we don't, but that's okay.
Well, it's interesting you brought up the metal thing and you're kind of aversion to metal, because like, I kind of feel like FYP is like a hardcore band, but there's almost like, as everyone's going metal and ultimately getting slower as the 90s are kind of going, yeah, you guys are just like a fast hardcore band, especially in that early 90s period, and like, yeah, stripped of all the metal, like stripped of all like the metal kind of pretension that kind of like seeps in and eventually changes everything. So I could see how it does feel out of whack. And it's interesting when you talk about bands that were doing like, I guess, quote unquote, traditional style hardcore, in the sense that they weren't going chug slow, yeah, stuff. How many times we wound up playing with ska bands just because it's, yeah, the only game in town.
It was that was the way it went. And you had to play with them. And so it was just like this thing where it's like, yeah, like, we could get along, like whatever, it's fine. But yeah, that was the thing that I worshipped was all those early 80s, 7 inches, like obviously the 7 seconds, Committed for Life, and Skins, Brains, and Guts, you know, the Minor Threat 7, all the Discord ones, and then once the you know, the metal mosh, you know, even I would even consider Youth of Today, like once that happened, it was kind of more, you know, on the you know, side that I was kind of like, well, this isn't my thing, but I accept this and I'm going to go to every show. And it became my thing, but I secretly yearned for that sound where it was just like, why can't bands sound like this? You know? And when Gorilla Biscuits first kind of like were along for that ride, I remember going, they're kind of like that. They're not, they have some metal, you know, riffs here and there, but they're kind of like that, especially that demo of the album, which, I remember being very disappointed when I got Start Today, like on vinyl. It was just like, this, what did they do? They went to that metal place. They went to the metal place. I just didn't know what recording studios were. And I was just like, they just went to the metal place that, you know, Youth of the Day and Judge are going to now. Like, they just went to the metal place. That's all. Like,
are you talking about that Walter Sings the Hits bootleg? Like, where Walter's singing all the songs for the demos for the LP?
I don't remember. I don't know. I think it's that, but I just remember somebody, like, I had friends that had connections with the straight edge scene, so they would always have like all the demos where it was just like, oh, check out this band, Gorilla Biscuits. And the 7-inch was out, but it was like, I got the album. And I was like, oh, shit. So I just assumed it was the album. And it could have been that, but it was very, it was just more lo-fi and more, you know, it wasn't as professional. And you listen to it now and you go, like I'm tripping. Like, this guy is off his rocker. The album's way better than this. But at the time, I just remember going, they're doing it. And I didn't know what the word overproduced meant. You know, it was just this, like, there's just something too shiny about this. And it's not supposed to be like this. And not that I have any say in this, but that's how I felt about it. And so once... I really got, you know, disillusioned from that kind of quickly. And I think, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, like, I tried to start a band with these guys, and there was literally a meeting about my attire. And it was you need to get new shoes, and they're going to be Nikes. And it was just like this thing where it's like, like, we're not trying to tell you how to dress, but you have to dress in this stuff. And yeah. It's just like, I thought we were starting a band, and you know, I don't know what I did at the time. I probably went like, yeah, whatever. If you buy me Nikes, I'll wear them. I don't care. Like, you know what? But obviously, they didn't do that. We do our first practice, and I get pushed over this amp because I was just goofing off. You know, it was just like, I thought that's what you're supposed to do in a band. You're supposed to, you know, have fun and goof off with your friends. And here this guy is with, you know, Nike sweats and Nike shoes pushing me over an amp, and I'm falling over an amp, and I'm like, okay, I'll see you guys, see you guys later. And I feel like my memory is horrible, but I feel like that Friday, let's just say that happened on a Wednesday. I feel like that Friday I went and saw MDC at the same places that I've seen Youth of Today a few times in 7 seconds. And that was it. They put me on to another path. Like, I took another exit, and I was like, oh, just right after that. It was like, Dave is up there. He's in some ballerina dress. He looks homeless. Like, it's just like this thing where it's like, he's not wearing Nikes. Fuck yeah. And then when they went in their set, I'm like, this is it. They're doing exactly what I want to hear right now. You know, and I put on Millions of Dead Cops, like, way more nowadays than Break Down the Walls. Let's just say that. Like, it's just, you know, which, you know, much respect to Youth of Today, because I loved them.
It's funny how fashion-y that Youth Crew stuff got. And
yeah.
And certainly when it came back again, it got really fashion-y about trying to get period correct clothing and stuff. But
Oh God, I can't even, I'm so glad I didn't pay attention to that. like it was the antithesis of everything why I was there, you know, why I was going to see still, you know, hardcore bands. It was the antithesis. It was like, no, this was freedom, and now you're trying to jail me again. What the fuck are you thinking? Like, but that was like, MDC was just a major breakthrough for me. Like, if these punk bands are psychiatrists, they were the ones that broke through. And I was like, okay, all right, let's stay focused here. Like, we got a future now.
Yeah, we covered John Wayne Was a Nazi with our friends last year, and it's like, you listen to that first LP, and it's like, every song, man, this band, like, these songs all still hit. And love all the records. Like, I go deep in their catalog, obviously, too. And then
that
record he did with Pig Champion, all about being peed on, that's a fantastic record in its own right too.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely one of my favorite albums, that one. And I could still put it on and just jump around the place like a 12-year-old. It does something where it's just like, no, that's the way it was supposed to be at that time, you know? We had a good blueprint, and someone fucked up a little bit. They must have burnt it and made up their own blueprint, but that was it. And everything seemed easier to, like, you know, it's like, you don't have to like this. You don't have to like that. You could just like this. And it definitely, like, blew my mind.
Yeah. Like, prior to, like, everything kind of getting factioned off and fashion-y, Like, it's always blown my mind how many different styles of punk there are in California at any given time, too. Like, little sub scenes, and like, at the same time, there's sort of the more, I guess, uniform choice, youth crewy kind of lean instead and Chain of Strength kind of stuff that's kind of popping off. There's also like No Comment, and then there's also like, I guess just before, like Muslim Birth and like that whole like Manson Youth and like that whole kind of like scene too. There are all these like pockets and cities that have different stuff, and it's just I don't know, like in high school, were there other like kids that were into it, like different sort of like punk kids around you?
Well, in high school, there was I mean, people are gonna, if anybody hears this now, they're gonna be like, "Bullshit, I was punk." There was literally two punks that liked, there was definitely, you had a bunch of goth, death rockers, goth rock that would wear Bauhaus and Bunnymen t-shirts, which I fucking love those bands. But at the time, there was one dude that gave me his own mixtapes, and where I found, it wasn't, it was like, MDC is up here. We don't need this on this tape. This is like this is verbal abuse. This is Sick Pleasure. This is that Code of Honor, Sick Pleasure split. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, I'm kind of stuck in this rut where I'm just, and so he made me these tapes. I sat with two skaters that, and we were kind of like the loners. We'd sit in the corner of the school, and there wasn't even skaters there at the time either. And the revisionist history of some of these people, they'll be like, no, that's wrong. But I remember it. I remember it specifically like that. My dad was the head football coach, and I was a skater that liked punk rock that sat in the corner of the school and didn't talk to anybody. So I don't know if you could imagine that dynamic, but I got a lot of shit. I got a lot of like almost, fist fights in classrooms because of that. And people wouldn't let it go. Like, I was like, I remember being a senior, and I was like, it's too late for me to join football, so stop giving me shit. And it was just like this thing where, no, I specifically remembered there was n just two skaters and, one real true punk that liked like true underground punk, and then a bunch of like, you might see a Sex Pistols shirt, but definitely Misfits, a lot of Misfits shirts, but they never heard of them. It was just like this thing where,
Yeah, because before the records got reissued.
Like
So it
the
was like,
Misfits.
yeah, the Misfits stuff. It was before that
Oh
Caroline reissue program.
And then I remember after high school, my friend Hal, he lived right by Tower, so I'd go buy some records and then walk over to his house and play them. And I remember specifically like finding Misfits reissues and going, dude, check it out. And he's like, that they're lame. They're so lame. And I'm like, you haven't heard them. And he's like, I know, but everybody wears a shirt, so they have to be lame. And I'm like, I agree, but let's just check it out. And then I put it on. I was like, and it was Earth AD, by the way. So that was one of my first like experiences with the Misfits as a kid, is like Earth AD. He's like, no, it's hardcore. Like, what else do you want? And he's like, I just can't get into it because of everyone wearing their shirts. And I'm like, well, okay, well, now it's different,
Yeah,
but
it's like that Sloan quote. It's not the band I hate, it's the fans.
there you go. It's but of course it's like now it's like, well, shit, like they've proven to be a very good band. It doesn't matter who's wearing the shirts. And but that was it. That was there was just a bunch of I'm not calling them posers, but a bunch of posers, I guess. Just nobody really helping me out besides that guy Scott. And he was very very generous with his tapes that he made for me. So
Were there any other bands coming out of locally that you were kind of getting into around that time?
Not really, no. There wasn't any, I mean, everything was already this. It's weird because I feel like the South Bay, I mean, Pennywise was happening at the same time. It was that, like, there was that, and then if my memory serves me right, but they definitely like were the other punk band. I think there was definitely other punk bands for sure, but South Bay was really dry at the time. I think it was, the well was dry, and it was I hear this from other people, so I'm not, don't quote me on this, but everybody, you know, tells me now, not everybody, but you know, enough people tell me now where it's like, in high school, you either liked FYP or Pennywise. You didn't like both. And I'm like, I know people who like both, like, you're tripping. And, but that was like this thing where I've heard from multiple people where it's like, if you like FYP, you don't like Pennywise. And it's like, well, we didn't, the band members didn't create this, you know, like the, yeah. that's what people are telling me. And there was, it was definitely like really hard to find, other bands to play with until we ran into, you know, Craig Ibarra's band, Rig, who were like kind of industrial. They sounded nothing like us, but it was like our, you know, let's get some shows together. And it, in a weird way, it made sense. We sounded nothing alike. It was like FYP, Rig, and this band called Rosemary's Billy Goat. And we would just like try to just play these shows. And Rosemary's Billy Goat is, I don't know if you've heard of Max Sabbath, but
yeah, Max Sabbath, of course.
Okay. So that's the main guy in that band, Mike. He was the main guy in Rosemary's Billy Goat. And it's like a like soft core version of Max Sabbath. Like it's props and, you know, song called, Pepperoni Pentagram, where he brings out a pepperoni pizza sliced in a pentagram and gives slices out. I mean, it was the whole nine yards. So. But that was like, it was like, so yeah, there was probably a bunch of bands, but we didn't relate to them, you know, enough to we were like, let's just go to the weirdos, you know, and we feel more comfortable with these guys. We sound nothing alike. And this is probably not going to appeal to people that want to go to shows and see this like jam packed bill. But it made sense and it was comfortable for us.
It's funny. Cause like I could definitely see, and obviously, yeah, like it's completely put on by people listening to the music, but like almost diametrically opposed approaches to kind of making hardcore music in a punk rock sense with Pennywise and FYP. Like, and, yeah. You're both on Theologian, like you both have this real shared, I guess, South Bay history bands. And like, ultimately, like yeah, I've hung out with those guys in Fletcher. I love hanging out with them terrifyingly and stuff. And I love hanging out with you too. So it's not any judgment, but like, I definitely could see how the two fan bases at that time would be kind of oppositional in a way, like not necessarily violently oppositional, but just like not necessarily seeing eye to eye on this thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like now it's hard to imagine just because it's, you know, people have more, you know, their minds are a little bit more open as far as sounds that come in. It used to be like, no, it has to sound like this type of hardcore. And I kind of just got it. Like when the first time I ever heard that, I was like, is it because we kind of sound shitty and they sound a little bit better? Like, I just didn't really get the, that there was something else beyond that where it was like, no, you're singing about this and they're singing about that. And, yeah, now it's just silly to separate, you know, anything in that way where it's like, you have to, it's like the whole Beatles and Stones argument where it's like, I like both. Like, I don't know where this came from where, you know, I get the conversation and it's fun. It's a fun conversation and you can say, who do you like better? But some people like both, you know, it's like, or some people like the Kinks, you know, you can like everything if you want. That's the goal, I think.
Well, there was money to be made in the secretarianism, right? Like if you adhere to this church and this brand of punk rock and buy these types of records, you know, ultimately the label that's putting out that type of records, and it was really label based, I found back then, and like what you wound up hearing about and just sort of like, you know, like you wear the label's t-shirts, like I like this Lookout. Yeah. I'm a Lookout kid versus a Fat Records kid.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, ultimately there's, yeah, like someone's like, no, you need to buy these types of records because this is the true version of this thing. And please support my version of this over the other version of it because.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need to keep the lights on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely at the end of the day, I love it. Cause we're both still playing shows and, it's one of those things where it's like, whatever, if it doesn't appeal to you, it doesn't appeal to you. And that's, that makes sense. I get that for sure. But
well, I love it all.
I don't like picking sides. Like, it's kind of, it's weird picking sides for things, you know?
Yeah. And especially cause like it, once again, it goes back to that boring thing. Like one version of this punk rock thing. Like if it's just bands that sound like Minor Threat, or if it's just bands that sound like Earth Crisis, like it, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear band. I want to hear all of it. I want to hear.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Which going back to, you mentioned, the tapes, like how long are you doing these tapes before you do the extra credit EP?
My memory sucks, but I'm pretty sure it was, 88 was the first tape. And then, the first 7-inch was in 90. So yeah. There was definitely 2 years of it. It feels like so much longer. Like between, I just remember doing tapes for so long. Where I found, you know, there's this place in Hermosa called Brico where they just had. It's to me, it seemed like just a tape store, which is completely weird and unheard of nowadays. But
you no, there's one in Toronto now. There's a store that only sells cassettes in Toronto.
Well. These were blank cassettes. Everything was blank to record on, whether it was like, you know, Ampex tape or just blank tapes that were with clear shells that you could, you know, put stickers on. And that's what I did. And you could buy everything there. So it was like such a little hole in the wall. And every time I went in there, it was dark and no one appeared to even be working there. So they would have to come out from the back and like, So I would go there, and it just seemed like a lot longer that I was doing this tape process where I would just dub them on my dual cassette player and then, you know, stamp the. I was just doing that for so long, but I guess 2 years makes sense. Like 88, you know, 88 to 90 were the tapes, and then 90 started the vinyl.
Well, on that, you do a Red Cross cover, and. That's the band that I think if I was going to like kind of put FYP following in a tradition of like more than like a Black Flag or something, it would be like a Red Cross and sort of like universe building and kind of creating your own world, because they're the first band out of that SST cult and kind of like doing their own thing. And like,
yeah,
they're the first kids to get bored with hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we actually covered that whole first 12-inch, and it was supposed to come out, I think, Junk Records. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Peyton from Hyrax ran it. He was going to put it out just as a 7-inch. I mean, we recorded the whole thing, and then we just used that song, like, for... I mean, no, it actually came later, but we definitely... I think I recorded I Hate My School probably, like, 5 times. And I was like, this is the best song ever. And it sums up FYP, because FYP started, like... All of this started accidentally. I never like wanted to be a musician. I thought they were kind of phony when I was this age. So I was just like, these are just notes that I'm leaving. I had a really, really bad government teacher that my first skate tour came when I was still in high school. So it was my senior year. And so, I talked to everybody about it. And I'm like, can I go on the skate tour? It's 2 weeks out of the school year. And they said, yeah, as long as you take this around for your teachers to sign saying they acknowledge it, and if they give you homework to take on the road, but it's not asking their permission, it's just saying they acknowledge that you're leaving so they could supply you with stuff. And everybody was like, that's great, good for you, this is fantastic. And I get to my government teacher, and he's like, I'm not signing this. And so I'm like, well, you don't have to. He's like, okay, so you're not going then? And I'm like, no, it just says you sign this acknowledging that I'm going. I'm definitely going. He's like, well, I'm going to fail you then. And I'm like, well, if you fail me, then I'm going to have to take independent study to graduate. And it was just like this, he was putting me like in a really bad situation. So he didn't sign it. I went, and then I started making, I made a song about him. And it was like, I made a lyric sheet, made the tape, and I put it in his desk. And like, he wasn't in our class yet. So I put it in his desk and sat there, and the whole class, I'm like, open your desk, asshole, open it. Come on. I never acknowledged him actually like opening his desk, seeing the tape, but he had to have gotten it. But it was like, had his name on it and everything. And it was, so that's how that started. And then, so it was just kind of like a school themed, like I hate school. And so I Hate My School was the ultimate cover song for me. It was like, it sums up everything. And then that whole 7-inch was all about, you know, school and how lame it is. And, you know,
yeah.
And yeah.
To me, they're like one of the ultimate bands in terms of punk bands. Like the, like from beginning to the new record's fucking amazing. Like,
yeah. They keep going. Yeah. They just toured too. Like
I saw them. Yeah. We played with them in, Nashville and, or not Nashville, oh, cool. Sorry, in North Carolina. And it was awesome. They were fantastic. And like, yeah, like another group that I think like a tour type thing where you can kind of like, obviously they break off and do their own things, but just the trajectory of that band and like the history of them just kind of like working on this project together for their whole lives. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Well, now here's the Roger Corman starts coming in. Spike Jonze, first ever credit in the entertainment industry, the cover on your record.
It was his first credit?
It's his first credit before he did the Wax videos, before he did any of the Sonic Youth stuff that people always bring up.
Oh, like in the entertainment, yeah, because he was doing skate.
Photos. Skate stuff, yeah. Like he did skate stuff, obviously, and like, and had. But
is
I
don't that true?
Think, yeah, huh. As far as I know. Like this is, I can't find anything pre 91. And even skate wise, like it's pre him doing Dirt, or maybe Dirt had just come out around then. 92, I think maybe Dirt comes out.
Maybe. I know we were hanging out. He was taking pictures for a magazine called Club Homeboy. And okay. He came over and he was just like a biker, you know, like a biker that wasn't really into metal. So I was like, this guy's interesting. Like, huh. We did some 4-track songs together. I know we had a song called Trick or Treat Girl and something else about Halloween. Cause I remember Halloween was coming up and it was like, we got to make a Halloween soundtrack. And, I wish I could find that song. Cause then
yeah,
I can exploit him. it's a good song though.
Years ago I had to do like a pitch meeting for Vice to him and I didn't bother doing any of my pitches. I spent the whole time just asking him about FYP and punk stuff, just being like, so were you in a punk? Like what's your deal? Like I gotta kind of figure this out.
What did he remember it?
He did. He was in shock. He was like very much like, I think, just taken aback that first of all that I was not there to pitch anything, that I just wanted to ask him questions about bands he had worked with and stuff. But yeah, he said he was like a DC punk guy and fan of like some DC things.
Yeah, he moved from D.C. to Torrance, and I know he lived with Meg in Baltimore, who kind of, she owns Girl, I guess, now.
Okay.
Yeah, they were like friends and roommates forever. Yeah, and they lived pretty close to me, so we hung out a lot. And, you know, I helped him get into the entertainment industry, obviously.
You did. You launched it. Like, this is the thing I'm saying, like, you got to find these songs. You already got, you know, because you changed the cover art for the 7-inch after the first pressing, right? So you can just recycle those photos again for the songs.
Yeah.
Put a jack-o'-lantern on for the Halloween theme. You know, I'm doing the graphic design for you here.
Yeah.
Also, Carlos de la Garza. When did Carlos start playing with you?
He was the first drummer. What happened was I was doing all the instruments by myself up until the second 7-inch, which kind of got started. My friend Jed, he went to my same high school, and you know, in retrospect now I could tell you he was definitely into like a lot of good music, but I didn't know him in high school. He was kind of, he just looked like this guy that looked like Ted Danson from Cheers. So I'd always go, oh, that's Sam Malone, that guy. And something was striking about him. And I don't know what it was, but I walk into where he was working. He was working at this place called Drug Emporium. And he's like, hey, you did that record, huh? And it was like, it was kind of like a weird local thing where even the guy that pushed me over the amp during that Straight Edge hardcore practice or whatever that was, saw me at a Target one time after the 7-inch came out, and he said, oh, so you got a record out now, huh? Oh, like it's on like a real label, huh? I heard. And I was like, no, just made it up on the spot. Like, and it's like, yeah, yeah. And the whole time I'm like, I know what you're doing, dude. Come on, just go get your tough kids or get whatever you're here to get. I don't know. Like, so he was being sarcastic. And then, Jed heard about the 7-inch too. And I'm like, this is where I thought I was just going to do this. And the boxes would be furniture when I was 60, like they would still be here. And he basically said, have you ever thought about playing live? And I'm like, no, like not at all. Like, he's like, so I could play, I'll help you. And I'm like, really, what do you play? He's like, what do you need? And I'm like, well, I play guitar, so bass. And he's like, do I have to buy a bass? And I'm like, you have to have one. You know, it's just like that kind of conversation. So he was like pretty much responsible for turning it into a band, or at least getting me to say yes to that. And then I don't know how we found Carlos, but I know it was through his best friend, Steve. We found him, and he wasn't doing anything yet, but he was an amazing drummer, and he was too good for us. Like, that was like the glaring thing about him. He was like a jazz drummer. Like, he had this piccolo snare, and it's just, everything sounded jazzy the way he played. But then when he tried to play along to it was not a drum machine, but I used a drum machine. It was like, I used the pads. So I was like, no, I'm not going to program anything. I'm just going to go digga, 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 digga. And so he tried to like imitate that. And that's, we called it the monkey beat, where it's just like, digga, 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 instead of, you know, or I know there's drummer terminology for it, but, it was like way too good. It was, you know, and the only reason why he left the band is he couldn't tour as much. And I would always be booking these tours. And then a week before they started, he was like, yeah, my mom doesn't want me to go on tour. And I was like, all right. So I just get anybody. Like, they didn't have to be a drummer. I just get anybody. And it would just be awful. Like, but I didn't know. I didn't, at the time, I was like, no, we're playing shows. It's fine. It's like, we all suck. This is not part of the... It's not part of the deal. Like, when they're booking us, they're not saying you better play good. It was just like, no, people are here, and that's all that matters. And
but that's the style within punk too, right? Where it's not about, and obviously he's an amazing drummer and went on Real Big Fish, and then, you know, like the production stuff he's done, and now Sire, yeah. Two punk musicians of another generation too, with the Linda Linda.
I actually just worked with him on something that's pretty, it's really funny, the Fiddler album. Yeah, they have a song that was one of my demos, and you know, Carlos and Zach came there, and it was like, wow, working with Carlos again in some weird way. So yeah, it was cool.
That's what I'm talking about, the Roger Corman thing. You know, I'm building my case record by record. I'm still just on the first single, between the first and second single.
Yeah, I'm not, you don't even have to build a case. It's open and shut. We settled already.
I do love that second 7-inch. I love the first 7-inch too, because I think there's like, yeah, like, and it's fitting that you do records on K Records at a certain point, because it's almost like in keeping with that side of thing, like a K Records, like Flying Nun, I guess, even aesthetic, like a real kind of like, I don't mean this in a way of amateurish in any sort of slight. I mean, like in the most like praise you can put on a record.
Yeah. The K thing was like, at the time it was like, okay, yeah, this is awesome. These people are cool. Olympia was like the first place that we felt like rock stars, actually. Like, the first tour we ever did wasn't a tour. It was just Calvin saying, hey, you guys want to come up here and play a show at a park? And we're like, yeah, if I could borrow my dad's van again. Yeah. And that was like the conversation. That was it. And next thing you know, by the end of that trip, we played like 7 shows, and it was all just like showing up. And, like, you know, we drove straight to Olympia, and there was a punk show going on, and we walked in, and somebody at the door said, "Are you guys FYP?" And we're like, "Yeah." trying to play it off, and they're like, "Will you guys get up and play?" Like, I was like, "Sure. Are we allowed?" Yeah. And it was great. We played the park show, and then somebody had an idea after the park show to play a laundromat. I heard Calvin Johnson was moshing at that. I didn't see it myself, but like there's people in the dryers. I mean, it was crazy. Like, it was just like this thing on the way down. Scott from Neurosis was doing a show in Eugene or someplace in Oregon. And we just like, let's just see what's going on. We hear there's a punk show, and it's like, he's at the door, and we're like, "Oh shit. Like, this is crazy. Like, can we get in?" And they're like, "You guys could play." And they're like, "Really?" It's like, what the fuck is this? Like, I booked one tour, one show, and the whole thing turns into a tour. And then after that, it was like, we got to do that again, except for this time I'm going to call places ahead, and they'll know that we're coming like a week or two before we get there. And it was like this big, big idea. Like, yeah, we'll call the clubs instead of just show up and say, "We're playing." Like,
but that's a magical thing about it when it works, because sometimes these tours do not work. But when they work and you just wind up out there, and by happenstance, you wind up playing a bunch of amazing shows just because you're there when they're happening.
Yeah. 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 It wasn't, I mean, there, it was just a shock like that, that could have happened. I mean, we never did a tour like that before, but there was a hybrid of that all through the 90s where you miss a show here, and then this show pops up, and you know, there was a lot of that, but there was never a tour like that ever again, nor should there be an attempt to do that. But you don't drive through 2 states, you know, with just 1 show and end up with 7 anymore. Like, that's that was definitely like cool, but it was definitely all based around Olympia, and that was like the first city that we went to where we felt, you know, a part of something, you know, like, and I don't know how FYP fits in the history of that. It's ridiculous to think about that, but that's the one where I look back and go, why did Calvin want anything to do with us? Like, what is this? Like, this is crazy. But it's great. Like, I love that part of the history with that.
I see, like, I really do see a similarity in approaches or like sonic philosophies, at least in the bands, like, you know, different styles, but just sort of the idea of like stripping away a lot of the edifice and just getting down to like, you know, the real, like the song, I guess, and like getting rid of like all the frilly guitar playing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. 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 I could see it. I could see it now for sure. Like, it's,
yeah. So, and then I guess Finisher Popcorn kind of comes out before Cooties, right? Finisher Popcorn comes out.
Yeah. Was that before?
Sorry, go on.
No, it was the first 2 7-inches, and then yeah, that was like the 4th release. The 3rd release was this band called Garden Weasel, and they're, you know, just this. Yeah.
Like, I got a whole page of Recess Records questions, believe me. That's going to be, I got a whole, that's a Recess Records section of this thing.
I got a lot on Garden Weasel.
Yeah, this is where, believe me, if you have to duck out at any time, Todd, because I'm just getting my warm-up suit off right now.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm fine. Yeah.
I'm going in. And then afterwards, I guess Cootie's 7-inch comes out. Was that first sort of like Pacific Northwest jaunt before or after the LP?
That's a good question. I'm pretty sure it was before, but I don't remember it. I mean, I'm sure I could look at the dates, but I don't even have the date on when that LP actually came out. I only have the dates on the back cover that we recorded it. So,
yeah.
I wish I kept better notes, but, I didn't think I would ever need them. So, I'm pretty sure it was before.
So how are you kind of getting distribution at this point? Like, are you just through Max Rock and Roll kind of sending stuff out yourself, or did you have someone kind of
it was mostly that, and my only official distributor at the time was Kay, and that's how we connected. It was basically my friend who recently passed. He told me how to do everything. Like it was like this thing where I had the tapes and I wanted to take it to the next level by putting out some vinyl of the same tapes. It just didn't matter. It wasn't anything to like start a label. It was just, I just want this on a 7-inch, just like Skins, Brains and Guts and all that stuff. And Mike Smith, who's the skater that I skated for, he was like, "Oh, talk to O. He'll tell you everything to do." And lo and behold, I talked to him, and he's like, he's telling me where to get it pressed. He's telling me where to get it distributed. He's telling me what stores to go to. He's telling me everything about everything came out of his mouth. And I'm like, okay, well, record's done. Now I got to call this guy Calvin, who I didn't have any like point of reference with. I did not know who he was. And it was just like, "Hello?" And I'm like, "Calvin?" He's like, "Yeah." I was like, "My friend O told me to contact you." He's like, "Oh, okay, yeah, send up 20. Click." And that was it. And that was it. And then next thing you know, I heard he's playing it on his radio show, and he liked it. And that was, you know, it all snowballed from there.
Yeah, O was, I didn't meet him till later, but what an amazing human being, and one of the purest music fans I've ever met.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw him. I was seeing him a lot recently before he died, and same dude, like same energy. It's crazy, like what kind of life he had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like one of those people that, because he wasn't in a band where you can say, look at this catalog. Like, I don't think until you like sit down and kind of like break it down for someone, can you appreciate the impact he had on music, because it's just so many different things, and so many, like, outside of the skateboarding stuff too, right? Like,
yeah with skating and music, like he touched everything. There was something about him where it's like, this didn't happen without O. Like, there's no that's Otis right there. No, like everything to me, I mean, especially, I don't think I would be talking to you right now if it wasn't for him, like steering me in that, those, you know, it's like MDC, O, there's like so many, you know, there's so many different things that, you know, you took a different road, and like, he definitely steered me in the right direction. He put me on the right road for sure.
Yeah. He's like the only guy that connects like that dog, Blink 182, 16, Rock from the Crypt, FYP. Like, he's just a dinosaur junior, like just all the worlds he's kind of like existing in, Melvins, like all this stuff that he's just kind of like attached to and part of. And it's just like, yeah, rest in peace. Like a truly remarkable person.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of people agree, for sure.
So I guess after the LP, you guys wind up doing the Cooties 7-inch, where you're on Theologian Records.
Yeah,
which is the first time I guess you're not self-releasing something.
Which was strange for me, because I, you know, at first I did it because I just thought it was so bad that no one else would want to touch it, so I just didn't want to like bother anybody. And then after I did the second one and the album, I was like, no, I could sustain doing this, and I don't want anybody else to touch it. But Mark from Theologian had a record store called Alternative Groove that I would go and visit frequently, and we became friends, and I was like, oh no, this, I could do it with him, you know? And so it was, and he also put out the Incomplete Crap CD, which was, I was totally not for CDs at all. Just for no other reason besides, just being young and like that, I guess. And my sister had CDs, so nah. But that, we did that, and I remember Negative Approach did their, what was it, Total Recall?
Total Recall, yeah.
Right when they did that, I was like, I gotta get a CD player. I remember having that CD without a CD player for years. Just going, one day I'm joining the dark side. But it was like all because they put out the CD that had everything on it, and you couldn't get any of that stuff, you know, without paying a pretty penny. So he put out the Incomplete Crap CD, and it was just one of those things where I was like, no, I, I'll you know, I'll work with him. And then we ended up doing stuff with other people, but it was, for the most part, it was very, I was reluctant to work with, you know, most people.
Theologian Records, that, what a cool label, like, so, like, Despise You and 16 and obviously Pennywise, who we talked about in 98,
yeah,
and that kind of stuff. But I always thought you guys, it was cool that you guys were on that label.
Yeah, yeah. And he, and it was good because he sold so many Pennywise CDs, and so he, like, he spread it out to everybody else, you know. So that was, like, that was another reason why it was like, yeah, we gotta, if he asks, we gotta do it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, anybody that does it like that is good. It's like, he knows this isn't going to make as much money, but he's using those funds for good cause.
Yeah, he's repurposing, profits from the Pennywise CD into putting out Dystopia 7 inches.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the Lord's work.
Yeah, Pessimizer, like that. Like, yep, there you go.
Well, yeah. Now we can move on to the recess portion of the conversation as I adjust my notes, because... yeah, there's a lot to talk about with Recess Records, because that is, talk about cool labels and, like, all sorts of cool, weird stuff you're putting out over the years.
Oh, thank you.
Well, and I guess, like, originally...
I never heard it being called cool, but thank you. That was the first...
Well, let me make that argument as we talk now. The thing I find interesting about the label is because it's not like... Not that K always reflects sort of the beat happening Calvin aesthetic necessarily, but, like, I think your label less reflects what you're doing musically yourself at times. Like, there's just, like, it's a lot broader sonically in terms of, like, the definition of what punk would be, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember there was a point, I think in the 90s where there was enough bands that kind of had the same FYP vibe, like the Grumpies, like, specifically, that I was like, you know, and I remember thinking, it was like, you know, Fat Records has this sound, and this is, I guess this would be the Recess sound, but then I kind of rebelled against that because you'd get pigeonholed really quickly with that, and especially, like, I say this, you know, fully loving everything I've done, but it, you know, most of it sounded like shit, you know, and it wasn't like this thing where it's like, we're gonna build a sound out of this, and it's gonna be like in every band we sign. And it's like, I didn't want to encourage that at all. Like, there was no way. It's like, we sounded like that because we didn't know how to sound in any way else, and the Grumpies sounded like that because they didn't know how to sound any way else too. So it was to ask other bands, it's like, this label's going to be dead in a year if I have to ask a bunch of bands to sound like this. So it just turned into this thing where it's like, whatever I liked, and it definitely had to have the, you know, a similar aesthetic, as far as, you know, I didn't want to work with any pompous, you know, people trying to be the next, you know, ska wonder. I definitely had opportunities to put out high, massive selling ska bands, and I said no to it because I could just, you know, smell something funny, and but it's basically just like turned into this thing where it's like, if I like it and I think it's, you know, fits our aesthetic, then let the chips fall where they may. If people, you know, say, what the fuck are you doing? They're still doing that to this day, like with, you know, like, Very Be Careful, like, I put them out, and they're like a cumbia LA band, and people are like, they're kind of, nowadays they're too scared to say, what the fuck are you doing, Todd? Like, before they would do that, and I'd be like, I'm putting this out, and it's gonna be cool, and doesn't end up being cool, but I did it, and I have no regrets. So it's, that's pretty much what it turned into.
Yeah, and I think Fats evolved into something very different, but there's also, like, people have said it on this podcast, like, different bands that went in there with sounding one way, and the record that came out on that label sounds different because there was sort of this, I don't know if it's a pressure in externally or internally, I'm sure it's different depending on the bands you ask to.
Yeah.
To make it sound that way, because, like,
yeah,
I would feel that pressure if I was on that label at that time, being like, wow, man, I got to fit in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know bands that literally told me that, where it's like, you know, whether it's Fat or Epitaph, it's like they're not being forced to do it, but they have an internal pressure to you know, because they do know that, you know, it's a high probability that we will gain a lot of fans if we go this route. And so it's not, I don't think it's anybody from the labels saying you have to do it like this and, or we're not signing you. I don't think it's like that. I think it's like an internal thing. And, but yeah, there's definitely, you know, I have problems with a lot of bands because of that. Not just Fat or Epitaph specifically, but just any sort of, it's I feel like they're going to the Kraft American cheese slice factory to make their album. And it's like, to me, I just can't feel anything from it. I feel like it's just stripped every layer off. And, you know, when punk is overproduced, it's something I can't vibe with at all. It's, you know, it's kind of like country, I guess. I love Hank Williams. I like Post Malone's new record, though. Go figure.
Oh, the country record they did?
Yeah. Post Malone's my new 7 Seconds, where I'm like, no, guys, come on. He's a country artist.
Go on, sorry.
No, you know that sound, though. It's like that new country sound. It makes me cringe. It's like, you know, but Hank Williams is one of my favorite musicians of all time. So you could, you know, I think someone could record, you know, let's just say, you know, I don't know, I don't really know country artists too much, but let's just say, you know, Chip Clydesdale. I don't know if that's a real person, but he re-records, you know, Lost Highway. It's not going to be the same song. So it's just, you know, I feel like punk is the same kind of music. It's kind of like that with certain like reggae and dance hall music. I feel like the more raw it was, the better it was to me.
I definitely agree with you. I think there's also part of it though where I love when it's not raw because it sounds wrong in a way. Like I love,
yeah, that. Well, there's certain bands, yeah.
And I like, you know, or even like that, what's the second Damned record, where everyone's like, oh, the production on that record sucks. I'm like, no, but it's kind of cool.
Because is that Music for Pleasure?
Yeah, that's the second one, right? With the abstract
Problem
painting.
Child.
Yeah, Problem Child and Cry Like a Wolf. Is that on there too? Anyway, I like that record. I like those records when there's like, I love the swing and the misses as well as I like the actual hits. But yeah, there's like and this is obviously going to be a very loaded word, but there's like a purity in the rawness to when you hear a punk record, and there's like no cheating.
Yeah. Well, I think Machine Gun Etiquette was not produced like the first album, and that's a great album. And
yeah,
I never questioned that it's a little bit more slicker than the first album. But that first album to me is a perfect sounding record. So yeah. I don't know if you know, it's, you can't do that. You can't go back and, you know, Monday morning quarterback this shit and go, well, if Machine Gun Etiquette sounded like the first record, then oh, Jesus Christ, the Damned would be so big. Like, they would have made it.
I love that stuff though. Like, this is our fantasy baseball, being able to kind of like go back and be like, oh wow, if this record had come out on this label, how different would things have gone? Or if this record hadn't come out, or because there is that, yeah, there's like that what if component too, like with it, where, yeah, what if the Cro-Mags first LP had sounded like the production on the demo more, or like you're saying, Gorilla Biscuits had gone with raw production on Start Today, would it have been as big a hit? Because there's something about the slicker production that makes it more mass appeal and does bring it to a different audience.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Like, it's like this thing where if everybody like recorded to my sensibilities, then no one would be popular, but I would be a pig in shit. I'd be like, yeah, but I wouldn't. I'd just be listening to records all day long and not working. But yeah, it's, and I get it. I get that, like, you know, just my upbringing and my first, you know, my first love of punk, it just sounded different. And you know, and you know, some people's first record was, you know, like you was like Propagandhi, like you know, the first Propaganda record. Some people, that was their first punk record, you know, a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So if that is, then you have a different, you know, you have a different point of reference, and your, you know, your style is going to be totally different.
Yeah. And I think there's a benefit and a privilege certainly with being able to like look at it from a distance, like you're, like we're talking about New Wind, to be able to go into New Wind and not have an expectation based on loving the crew or you know, like the 7 inches, and being able, like, obviously not yourself, but like other people who were felt like put off by that record and hurt by that record. I didn't have that baggage. So when I heard it, I was like, oh, what are these guys talking about? This thing's awesome in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's just, there's a different kind of feeling to it. And like the Propaganda record is just one of those records that, I think people underestimate how big it was. Like, I remember talking to someone back then, they were like, oh, it's the number one selling record on Fat right now. And it's interesting. Like, I guess this is jumping ahead, 'cause like, believe me, I got Yamos questions and Bored to Death questions too, but like that 10 inch, arguably one of the top 10 10 inches of all time, certainly in punk. Maybe I would put it on my greatest Canadian records list of all time, the Propaganda I Spy Split, which is after that first LP, but pre. So how did that kind of come about? Because like that first record was popular, right? Like it was really talked about. Like, did you know them before that, or?
I don't think so. I think, I remember doing a couple shows, like just setting up shows, with Born Against. And then, Chris Hanna heard that I was doing shows at the Hong Kong Cafe, which was an old punk club too. So it was like, it was a double, like, oh yeah, like I get to set up Born Against here. This is, they don't even know what's going on yet. Like, so I think Chris, I'm pretty certain it was after How to Clean Everything, and I did a show with them and at the Hong Kong, and after that we just became good friends, and the 10 inch was we talked about it like the first week we knew each other, but it was supposed to just be just a Propaganda album, you know, and then it turned into, no, let's do a 10 inch. And then they're like, we have, our friends have a really good band called I Spy. And then it just turned into that. And, it's one of my favorite 10 inches ever too. And that's another thing that I remember, right when that was done, I took a drive up with Chris, 'cause we wanted to talk to Fat Mike about the second record. And I remember him saying, like, he's all, just don't make it sound like the 10 inch. And I just remember going, wait, what? And it was my first like experience of somebody talking about production like that, where I was like, what's wrong with the 10 inch? That, like, it sounded too good to be on Recess. So I want to know if he's thinking it was too good or too bad. And I'm like I'm just like a fly on the wall, just like listening to this and going, but yeah, it, like, apparently it sounded like shit. And to me, that sounded like better than anything they did up until that point, you know. Yeah. But also, the songs were these amazing songs. So, you know, you don't, it's hard to do. It's just like the Damned. It's like hard to say that, you know, this would have been better or bigger or this or that. But I just remember, I guess that was raw. I guess that was a raw recording. And I know they re-recorded two of the songs for Less Talk, More Rock, and they were produced, you know, a little bit more slick, but I didn't actually care. It was like one of those things where it's like, no, these songs should sound like this. Like, I get it. Go back and you A-B them, like, oh, okay, I get what Mike was talking about. I get it. Okay, all right. But I still liked it better. Like, there was just something about it where it's like, that was the first version I heard, and there was nothing wrong with it. You know, and that's what I guess that's what's different, where it's like, I don't see this as wrong at all. And
yeah, that's the thing about Propaganda is, I think, like, sonically, because the similarities, and I think they're coming at the music completely differently than NoFX was, but because of the similarities to the style, they get lumped into that world. But like you're saying, they're you talk to them, they're from the Born Against side of this punk rock world a lot more. And that's, I think, reflected in that 10 inch and, you know, certainly in the double 7 inch that comes after it. But yeah, that 10 inch also in terms of a split, it's like as great as the Propagandhi side is, I think that I Spy side might take it. And that's why it's like one of my favorite splits, because both bands are so good on it. And like the I Spy 10 inch that you do later on, I love, but like the production, just something about the songs on the I Spy side are just like, there's nothing that sounds like it to me. Like that's true emotive hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
And,
I was going to say, I agree again.
Yeah. going back, now we can jump back. Sheep Squeeze, the Fume split, Fume's underrated band, Sheep Squeeze, Dan from Spaz. First band,
too. Yeah, and a little goof core band. Yeah.
Yeah, great band. Also, weirdly, did a split with Sockeye, who Propagandhi, unbeknownst to them, did a split with Sockeye, too, till after it happened. So a Sockeye connection as well. But yeah, like I love that Sheep Squeeze, and I love the Fumes. I think that band, the first 7-inch and the split, I think they're super underrated.
Yeah, that was another band that we kind of clung to early on, where you know, they were like a Southern California hardcore, I guess. And that was like the same time the Offspring was coming up too. Like I remember playing a show with the Fumes and Offspring and some garage, and they were kind of similar, but the Fumes were a little bit more hardcore, and they had the definitely underrated band.
The Offspring have got to be like the band that succeeded that probably seemed like the least likely to succeed, right?
Oh yeah
like it's crazy when you look.
Yeah, shocking. Yeah. Yeah,
and everything about it like just screams not commercial, and then there we are a few years later.
Oh, no. I have no response to that. Like, yeah.
Well, then you do, I think you do Before Bored to Death, or maybe it's after, the Quincy Punks 7-inch, which seems like a weird collision of worlds, you know, being the East Coast band and being more of like kind of part of like, I guess, the Oi street punk scene. How did that come about?
Quincy Punks, that's a good question. I have to remember that one.
Cause you had like 3 records with them too, right?
Yeah, I think Jason that did THC Records, me and him traded records all the time. And that's what kind of, you know, the first 10 Recess releases, I was heavy into trading to sell just so I could make a catalog to send out with mail orders that say, I have this too, and I have that. So I was trading with Jason from THC, and he sent me that first Quincy Punk 7-inch, and I'm like, this is great. This is like, okay, all right, we're getting somewhere now. Like, we're getting back to like early 80s hardcore and, you know, and just punk and Germs Worship and all that. So he's like, you want to do a 7-inch with him? And so he put me in touch with him, and that was it. Next thing you know, we're going on tours together, you know, like 8 dudes in a van and, you know, for six weeks, and it, you know, yeah, that was, they're from Minneapolis. Yeah.
Oh, Minneapolis. Sorry. I thought, Minneapolis. I apologize. Yeah.
No, they ran deep with Blank 77. So they played a lot up there. So
that makes sense. And then Bored to Death, I think, is pretty soon after that, maybe, or just before. That 7-inch is fucking awesome.
Oh God. It's one of my favorites. Like, for sure. To this day, I still think it's in the top 5 of things that I've released, for sure. Like, it never gets old. I always love playing it, and people really want it. And it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm not giving it to you. Sorry. Like, it's, it's one of my favorites, and I kind of want to keep it a lost gem for a few more years. And then maybe reconnect with the band if they're not all dead. So reissue it.
Yeah. Cause I don't know if anyone from that band went on to do anything else. It's like, seems like a band, a record that really got rediscovered in the last few years by people.
Yeah, Annie went on to do something called Annie and Candy Klutz, and they were great too. Like they had a song on a compilation I did.
Oh yeah, they're on not, the second volume two, right? Or
yeah,
right?
that abortion song. Like,
that's right.
I am abortion if I want it. It's just like it's kind of like less hardcore, but still in the same vein where it's like yeah this is like. She's a great singer. I haven't heard from her in years though. Tony, who's in the band, got in touch with me maybe 5 years ago, but I haven't heard from anybody else.
And then you're supposed to do Beat Off, or at least there's a test press for the Queers Beat Off.
Yeah, I was gonna do pretty much all of them, and then I think Asian Man came in and.
So that wasn't when Beat Off With came out? Like, it wasn't back then? It was, like, later kind of reissue?
Yeah, there was, are you talking about the Queers?
Yeah, the Queers record. I thought you were doing it before Lookout did it. Like, I know there's a test press that...
No, okay. No, Beat Off came out on Lookout.
No, I know it came out on Lookout, but I always thought, I don't know why, but there was a test press listed as coming out in 94 on Recess.
Yeah, I was going to reissue all the Queers albums, and then it's funny because I remember going to a Dodger game with Mike Park and from Asian Man, and he's just ribbing me the whole game on. He's like, why do you put out vinyl? Like, you're crazy. It's so expensive. Just put out CDs. What are you doing? And then 6 months later, he's poaching the Queers catalog from me. You motherfucker. but yeah, that was just like one of those things where everybody agreed, like me, Joe, and Mike were all just like, yeah, it's better out of my hands right now because I just get overwhelmed and I bite off way more than I can chew. And it was like, yeah, I can't complete this project. And so it became in good hands. So.
And I guess also your refusal to put out CDs is what leads G7 Welcoming Committee to be formed by the Propagandi guys, because they do the CD version, right, of the 10-inch?
Yeah, yeah.
So your love for vinyl had ramifications, both positive and negative in that way, because G7 put out a lot of really important records up here.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure.
Also, Yeah, Mos, the 7-inch, which is pre-Chick Chick Chick. Another Roger Corman-esque
moment. There you go. That 7-inch is great too. Like they were a great live band. That was a band we always played with when we were going up north, especially when we were playing Sacramento. We'd play with either them or the Bananas or once the Secret Center bands. Like, but even Gilman Street, we'd always try to hook up with them. So, yeah, I had to put that out. It was good.
Well, I could go on and just punish you about every single record, but I'm not. And any time you want to come back on this podcast, Todd, you are welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I love it, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
Sure. Well, and before I let you go, you did put out one record I wanted to ask you about, because even though it's a posthumous release, I can't imagine it would have been a without incident release. The Gigi Allen Final Recordings and Last Interview CD.
Yeah, part of the book.
It's part of the book, right? Like, it's a bonus disc in the back of the book.
Yeah, now the book doesn't even have that. But yeah, it was Evan Cohen is he's the author. He went on tour with Gigi Allen, and he was in the band Furious George, who I released. So yeah, he went on tour with us one time to promote the book too, and. Some crazy. It was actually a Recess Records tour, which is insane to think of now. But we were in West Palm Beach, and we had a very interesting situation where the security guard was fighting me, and all this big melee broke out. And then we get into the car, and Evan's just like, "I've never seen anything like this. You guys are crazy. You've never seen anything like this." And it's like, you fucking went on tour with Gigi Allen, motherfucker. He's like, he's nothing like it. It was all show. It wasn't like this. It wasn't like this at all. He's just like freaking out. I'm like, please calm down. I need to calm down. I'm the one who's getting hit. Come on. Like, so that was a funny little anecdote about that and him and that book. And
That's
and
amazing.
It all started. The fight started because we were Gigi was dead, but he wanted to sing happy birthday to Gigi and hold up the book, and so it was kind of like a plug and a nice gesture for his friend, and it turned into a fight, a big barroom brawl.
I imagine you just like with that kind of book reading, you'd attract a certain type of element that's just like, especially post hated, like just looking for the altercation.
It was what happened was the club hired a skinhead for security, and I'm talking about, you know, I know people say there's good skinheads, but
the really not good kind.
The really not good kind, which was a dumb thing to do, and one of his skinhead friends started yelling at him while he started singing happy birthday, and I said something rude to that guy, and then it just turned into that, and melee.
Yeah. Well, this has been a melee of fun, and anytime, Todd, you want to come back on here and talk about hi-fi, lo-fi, no-fi, I'm here
All right.
it.
All right. I'll take you up on that offer.